Today, we'll be listening to a conversation with Native American artists Margaret Bagshaw and Juan Quictasie Smith. It took place on March 11, 2012, at the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture Auditorium on Museum Hill in Santa Fe. Leading the conversation were Shelby Tisdale, director of the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture, and Carolyn Kastner, associate curator at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum. The conversation is in conjunction with the Margaret Bagshaw exhibit, Breaking the Rules, at the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture, and the Juan Quictasie Smith exhibit, An American Modernist, at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum.
I'll go ahead and get started here. I'm Shelby Tisdale, director of the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture, and I want to welcome all of you here this afternoon for a conversation with Juan Quictasie Smith and Margaret Bagshaw, two phenomenal artists who we're just honored and delighted to have here this afternoon. I think what you're going to find is that these two incredible artists, women artists, are going to have a lot of things, wonderful things to share with you. And I think if you haven't seen Margaret's exhibit here, Breaking the Rules, I invite you all after the show this afternoon to take an opportunity to go through the exhibit. I'm the curator, co-curator, actually. Margaret and I co-curated this exhibit together. We started about 3 years ago, in 2009, when Margaret and her husband Dan came back to the U.S. after spending a little time in the Virgin Islands. They came back and started a gallery called Golden Dawn Gallery, and I started going over and visiting Margaret usually on the weekends, just kind of putzing around downtown, and I'd stop by the gallery. I met Margaret, first of all, when I did an exhibition of her grandmother, Poblita Velarde, back in 2007, and I would stop by her gallery every once in a while, and one of the things about Margaret is that she doesn't have an off-site studio where she paints. She paints at her gallery, and I started watching her paint, and I became intrigued with her whole process, and then, of course, looking at what the end product was, and I became interested in how she became an artist, and so we started talking. And I saw an opportunity to do an exhibition of her work. So we have a 20-year retrospective of Margaret's work. It includes pastels, oils, as well as two-dimensional pieces, clay pieces, as well as bronze, and then some painted wood. So before I really convince you to go into the exhibit, and I think you'll be more convinced at the end of the hour, I'd like to turn it over to my co-host, Carolyn Kastner, who helped put this together, and she's going to talk more about Jean and her exhibition.
Thank you, Shelby. So, is this on?
Well, yep.
Now it is. Okay.
So thank you very much, and this is a wonderful opportunity, and I think for Jean and me, this has been a journey that has had many twists and turns in it. We share some very dear friends who introduced her artwork to me, and over time I have been working on Jean's artwork something like 7 years now. And so the exhibition itself came up not as associate curator of the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum, but because I was a scholar at the Georgia O'Keeffe Research Center. And many of you may know about the museum, but you might not all know about the Research Center. And the Research Center is focused on the study of modernism from 1890 to the present. And it may come as a surprise to you to know that there have been many scholars there who have looked at Native American art. I just happened to be the first one to also follow my research into the gallery. So in 2008, as a scholar at the Georgia O'Keeffe Research Center, Barbara Bueller-Lines, the curator there, invited me to do an exhibition in the Living Artist of Distinction series at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum. So that's a lot of words. Now let me tell you what that was about. So the mission of the George O'Keeffe Museum is dedicated, obviously, to the legacy of George O'Keeffe, but the ongoing study of that legacy and defining that legacy. And as part of that, the Living Artists of Distinction series brings living artists into the museum. And so when I was a scholar there, I was working on a book that I have written on Jean Quictusie Smith's artwork, and Barbara Lines saw the artwork and said, I want this art in our museum. So we began to work on that from 2008, never imagining that there'd be a day that I'd be associate curator at the George O'Keeffe Museum. So it's been my great pleasure to bring this all together here as a curator. And it turns out that was a pretty lucky thing, because Jean has been a very prolific artist, and she's been shipping her art all over the world. And it turned out it took quite a few letters, emails, and internet research to track down the exhibition that we've put together, which is Jean Quictusie Smith, an American Landscapes of an American Modernist. And it focuses on one specific suite of paintings that she created between 1985 and 1987. And those works focus on the Petroglyph Park controversy that was taking place in the 80s. And I know it's gone on. For me, that was a significant body of work that expressed the power of her modernism in the genre of landscape. And so when I set out to track those paintings down in 2008, I didn't imagine it would take three full years to find some of those. And some of them was just the luck and the spirit of curators who cooperate with each other. One lender that we could no longer find their address, and it was an elderly couple, I found their name on the internet as donors to a museum in Florida. And so I called a curator in Florida and said, I know you can't give me that donor's phone number, but can you pass this request along? And that picture is in this exhibition. So that's the kind of thing that happens. In another case, we had a painting that was part of a corporate collection, and that corporation was bought out twice since the 1980s. And I had to track them through all of their financial dealings. But I hope you'll come if you haven't already to see the installation of those oil paintings. In addition, we have a gallery of her works on paper, primarily pastels, and some with collage and text as well. So that gives you a little background about both of the exhibitions, and we're here today to really talk to these two artists then about their artwork. So I'm going to start with a question. And I'd like each of you to answer it, either together or sequentially or back and forth in conversation. How did each one of you become interested in painting as a career path? And I'm particularly interested in you addressing the turning points that guided your journey, because you both are well advanced in your career and have shown your work in many places. And I'm also interested, and I know our guests are too, who encouraged you, who inspired you, who influenced you.
I have to say that my father was the big influence in my life, because he was a horse trader and he built his own corrals, and I would watch him at the kitchen table braiding his lariats. And I saw the corrals as sculpture, and I saw the lariats as artful. And so I saw that everything, the way he did things, like plant his garden, as a piece of art. And when I went in the first grade, we didn't have kindergarten. We lived in a really rural area. You know, the first things that I came across were crayons, and they smelled like grape jelly to me, and then, you know, library paste. And most Indian children smell things, and then they taste them. And I did exactly that, and I found that the crayons were crumbly in my mouth and not very tasty, and the tempera paint was kind of gritty, and the library paste actually was quite good. So this was my first, I guess you could say this was my first art experience, and that led me into wanting to be an artist even before I knew the word artist. And at age 13, I rode in the back of a pickup truck with the Nisei farmers that I was working for. I began working as a field hand when I was 8 years old. My Social Security number goes back to age 8, which I doubt anybody in this audience has a Social Security number that goes back to that age. And at age 13, I rode in the back of the pickup truck into town to see Toulouse-Lautrec. And that was my first image of an artist, and it was a male, and he was very short. He had a bone deficiency. So I had a photograph taken of me on my knees with a hat that I pushed on my head, my father's axle grease on my chin, and I have that picture at age 13 because that's when I transformed myself into an artist.
Well, my first experience with tasting paste was in first grade, and it was really good. Art, I did not choose art. Art chose me. I did everything I could to rebel. I did not want to be an artist. There were enough artists in my family. I just sort of thought, art to me was, the process of creating art was a very normal thing in our house. It was as normal as, you know, planting a garden in the spring or, you know, going to the grocery store or fixing dinner or, you know, it was a normal, mundane thing. Grandma did it and Mom did it and I just didn't want to do that. I wanted to be a doctor when I grew up. And, you know, I would have a little clubhouse. Grandma would, you know, stop her painting in the middle of getting ready for Indian market and realize that she had to do something to entertain us kids. And so she would stop, and in the middle of the day, she would go find scrap lumber and build us a clubhouse in the backyard and tie a rope to the tree and say, okay, there, don't bother Grandma. And so she would get back to painting. We would have our clubhouse, you know, and you know, I would open a little clinic or something like that in the clubhouse. And then pretty soon we wanted a swimming pool in the backyard. So she'd go to Sears and she would buy a swimming pool that started out that tall. And she would set up the swimming pool and the rope. We'd swing off the clubhouse and with the rope into the swimming pool. And then when we got bored, we would say, well, Grandma, what else is there to do? Well, you want to sit down and paint? Okay. So we'd sit down and paint. She'd put out a piece of brown paper on the floor and put out some of her paints, and she'd say, okay, now don't bother Grandma. And so it was always about don't bother Grandma. Now, if I was at my mom's house, which I primarily lived with my mom, although secondary it was Grandma, I would say, you know, Mom, can I paint? No. Go find something else to do. Mom, there's nothing else to do. It's hot outside. Then sit down and watch some TV. But I'm bored. And she said, well, then find something to do. You need to find something to entertain yourself. I don't have time. I have to paint. And so I was not allowed to touch the pastels. I was just forbidden to touch the pastels because they were dry and messy and they got all over everything. I was not allowed to touch her paints because those were Mom's paints. They were off limits. So I got out the scissors, the tape, and the paper. And so I would cut things and I would make sandals and I would make hats and, you know, all kinds of things. And about 22 years later, somebody else was getting into my paper and tape and paint and scissors. But I had a need to be creative. I just didn't think that I wanted to do what my mom and my grandma did. And so it was sort of a set of circumstances. I was pregnant, broke, and I couldn't sleep. And so I would get up and draw in the middle of the night. And it was sort of, it came to me. I didn't go get it.
You are listening to a conversation with Native American artists Margaret Bagshaw and Juan Quictesee Smith, with comments from Shelby Tisdale and Carolyn Kastner.
And both of you have had a long journey being artists from these beginnings that you're describing. So will you also just bring us up to speed on who and how you became the artist you are? So from the beginning, you were both describing a visual environment that was very rich, but also there's education, mentors, inspiration along the way that you stayed with this career.
You know, my intent was to become an artist, and I went to community college in Bremerton, Washington, and it was all veterans from the Korean War. I was the only woman in the class. And at the end of the year, the professor called me in and said that women could not be an artist. Only men could be an artist. And he recommended that that I leave the art department and that I take up teaching or social work or some other thing that was befitting a woman. And this is not an unusual story for the 1950s, because remember, that was at the time of Jackson Pollock and Motherwell and, you know, the men's club at the Cedar Bar in New York. It was a very typical story that women could serve an artist, but they, a male artist, but they couldn't become an artist themselves. And somehow Georgia O'Keeffe floated through that whole situation and came out the other side. But for myself, I turned away from it, made art on my own, sold it in small shops, and kept on doing it myself, and then went back to school and decided that I would become an art teacher. And then my big goal was to come to Santa Fe and join IAIA and be a teacher with Linda and Carita, who I didn't know at that time, but later. And eventually wound up on the board of directors. Mentors who helped me along the way as I dropped out of school due to economics and back into school again, who helped me, were Lise and Harvey Hoshauer in Albuquerque, Betty Parsons in New York, Esteban Vicente in New York. I've had some really interesting people who have mentored me through this, and I would have to say there are probably easily 60, 70 people that I could name, and we won't do that, but that gives you an example of you just never can do this on your own. You always need people helping you along the way, and I'm grateful to each and every one of them. Carolyn, of course, is number one on my list.
I'm present.
And present. She's present.
I would say that my situation was different in that the women in my family ran the family, and they were artists. So I didn't have that great word of wisdom, no, you can't be an artist. I knew very well I could be, because they did it and they were successful at it. When we talk about mentors, I think first of my grandmother's mentor, who was Tonita Pena, first female artist in a group of the self-taught five. She was the one who told my grandmother that it was okay for women to paint if they wanted to. My mother's mentor actually was not really an arts mentor, but more of a life mentor early in her life. And that was a teacher of hers, Sister Marie Antoinette, at the Catholic school where she was at. She really was somebody who gave my mother her own self-esteem and showed her that she was a good person and that she was capable of being who she wanted to be. She just needed to pray for a real vocation. And as far as mentors in my young life go, during my preteen years, I was at Santa Fe Prep. Arlene Llewellyn was one of my very first mentors. She started out as my eighth grade art teacher and taught me history. And even though she left prep while I was still there, she and I stayed in communications, and she was always encouraging me. She was the one who got me started going into clay in eighth grade, and then I followed up going into high school. And then And then we didn't see each other. After we moved to Albuquerque, my family moved to Albuquerque, I didn't see Arlene. I would stop in her gallery if it was open, and I would stop in, you know, the night before Indian Market and look at Jean's shows. And I was just always sort of admiring from afar. And then after I started doing my own artwork, just a couple of months after I really sort of made a commitment to doing my own artwork, I get this phone call. I was in a group show at the University of New Mexico, and I get this phone call, and she said, "Margaret, this is Jean Quick to see Smith. I saw one of your drawings displayed at the Student Union building." And she said, "I'm so excited." And you have no idea what that meant to me. It was the words of encouragement from outside of my family. Yes, my grandmother was going to encourage me. She would have encouraged me if I had learned how to bake cookies. But coming from a professional woman who made her living creating art and teaching art, that was important to me. And that stuck with me for a very long time.
Thanks, Margaret. Let me say that Margaret's father was my photographer for many years. And so I would see Margaret's mother from time to time, an exquisite, beautiful woman who I admired from afar. And so when she passed away, and I was doing the Women of Sweetgrass, organizing that exhibition, which was the first traveling Native American woman's exhibition in the country, with Harmony Hammond and Lucy Lepard. I dedicated the catalog to her mother. And
I remember
so
that.
Seeing Margaret's piece was, you know, like seeing a motherless child. It meant that I needed to do something. And I was so taken with her piece and her striving to be an artist on her own.
Thank you very much. later on, as I'm still sort of on the mentor thing, later on, Jean helped me get into a show called We the Human Beings. And it was only supposed to last for, a year? And it was extended to 2 years. And I thought, oh my gosh, I can't believe that they're going to have my pieces for 2 whole years. What am I going to do? I guess I have to make more. And dropping my pieces off to Jean, she was always saying, "Well, Margaret, just send me slides. I don't have a camera. I can't afford a camera." And so she said, "You know, you need to make that a priority because people want to see your work and you need to take pictures of your work." And so in 2009, I bought a really expensive camera, and then I hired a photographer to take pictures of my art. So, anyway.
Thank you. I'm going to ask the next question, but before I do, I forgot to mention at the beginning, we're going to pass around a basket that's got note cards in it. For you in the audience, if you have any burning questions that you would like us to ask. We have kind of a set group of questions, but it doesn't mean these are the only ones. And so at the end of our questions, we will open it up. And so if you have any questions that you would like to ask that are coming to mind right now, please go ahead and fill out the card. We'll collect these in about another 15, 20 minutes. So I'm going to ask the next question, which I should just mention even before I ask this next question, that right now with two major museums in the city, in Santa Fe, this is the first time two major museums have had exhibitions on two Native American women artists. I think this is pretty phenomenal, and I don't know of any other city in the country that's done this, so I think this might even be a first. So with that said, I would like to ask this next question, and it has really to do with the fact that they're both very successful artists. And as successful Native female artists from two distinct generations, you have each distinguished yourselves in what is considered a male-dominant career. what would you attribute to your success? What would you say has kind of separated you from other artists, and especially from some of your male counterpart artists?
Go, Margaret. Okay. Bottom line, hard work. It's absolutely hard work. This is not a glamorous career. Yes, you may have one glamorous night at your art opening where you can actually take a shower after not bathing for a week, you know, while you're getting ready for your show, and your hair is all pulled up on your head and you've worn your sweats for 3 days. But the reality is commitment. I saw my mother and my grandmother paint every single day of their lives, whether it was good times or bad. That's what they did. They did not get other jobs. They stuck to their guns, and just my grandmother was not proud. She if she had to go out with a batch of paintings and go drive to Arizona with an ice chest in the back of her station wagon and load it up with paintings to go peddle in Arizona or Oklahoma, she was fine doing that. To her, it was a working vacation. You know, she wasn't too proud to walk into a trading store and say, you know, do you want to buy some of my earth pigments or some of my ceremonial paintings? She knew that she had to stick to it because she had kids to raise. And after her kids were grown up, she had grandkids to raise. You know, it was about being committed to something that you're absolutely passionate about and continuing to learn. You know, my grandmother and my mother loved showing at the museums, but they also liked going to the other museums and looking at the artwork that other artists did. They liked having friends who were artists and learning different different techniques or different methods. You know, they didn't really stray from their own way of doing things, but the more they learned, the more, you know, they were able to expand with their own things and their own way of thinking. And so I saw this, you know, they did not sit me down and teach me how to paint. They were not instructors to me. They were my mother and my grandmother. And the way they did things embedded itself in my way of thinking and doing things to the point where either I know how to do it the way they did it, or I can do it completely different from the way they did it. And so, but the bottom line is that it's hard work and doing whatever you have to do to make it possible for you to do it the next day. We have people coming in the gallery, you know, saying, oh, it was so wonderful that somebody afforded your grandmother the time and ability to be able to paint the way she wanted. You know, that is absolutely ridiculous. She did what she had to do, and so did my mother. My mother was the breadwinner in our family. My mother had to create shows, paint for gallery shows, exhibitions at the Heard Museum. There were shows every 2 months that she was getting ready for. We were building a house out in Tasuki, and it was costing a fortune, and she had to pay the bills, you know. And so it was this constant need to completely do more. And as I watched this happen, I think the work ethic is what I got out of that relationship, the nonstop drive to keep doing it and to keep pushing myself to do better and to strive more. I'm extremely competitive. I don't hold back when I have to say something. I just say it. You know, at 47 years old, you start realizing that there is no time to sugarcoat anything. You just do it. You know, and I look at young artists, you know, and I look at, you know, and they give it a good go for 5 years, and then they aren't rich, they aren't driving a Mercedes, and they don't live in a five bedroom house. They're going to go do something else, you know. you stick with it until it's successful.
You know, when I started showing here in Santa Fe, I had organized a group in Albuquerque called the Great Canyon Artists. And it was because those of us who graduated from college, those Native Americans who graduated from college, weren't really being recognized by the galleries here or the museums because our work wasn't seen as traditional, meaning there was a certain look to certainly crafts here in Santa Fe. And then T.C. Cannon and Fritz Scholder kind of set the standard for Native pop art, I guess you could say. Alan Hauser, Earl Biss, Neil Parsons, all of the what we women talk about when we're by ourselves, when Karita and Linda and I and Margaret are by ourselves, what we call the warriors.
You wouldn't be talking about the warrior braves, would you?
Yes. Yes. And this is a secret for all of you in this room. We can't talk about this outside of this room.
You can spread the secret, though.
But it's okay. Because I don't see any of them in this room. And so that generally is the tip-off, that we don't always we are not always supported by the men artists. And in all these years, often we've gone to their lectures and we've gone to their openings, and they are not reciprocal. They aren't as much into sharing. And I have to tell you that when I started exhibiting in galleries with the Indian men, because often I was sometimes there alone, they would be at one end of the room and I would be at the other end of the room, and they would sort of ignore me. And so that's kind of how I started my career here. And it's gotten better. I have lots of men artist friends, and they do talk to me now, but they aren't, I don't think, they aren't as supportive as the women artists are.
You know, I had a similar experience when I joined, there were a couple of galleries that I joined. One was a very young contemporary gallery, Blue Rain Gallery, and it was funny because my first show with them was in San Francisco, and all of the men were over on the other side of the room, and I was over here with my art, you know. And I guess Tammy and Jody felt sorry for me, so they came over and they hung out with me. And that was sort of always the going thing, you know. And then I went to Ventonic Fine Art Gallery, and I outsold both of the men who were twice my age there.
Who shall remain nameless here today?
If you say so. If you say so. It was at Ventana Fine Art. I outsold both of those artists, and the next year I outsold both of those artists, and one of the artists just left. So it was, they don't like to be shown up. They don't like women to show them up. And that is a traditional Native man's point of view, is that women should not arise above them. My grandmother caught hell for it. My mother caught hell for it. I'm not catching any hell, but I also haven't seen any men on my side of town either.
You are listening to a conversation with Native American artists Margaret Bagshaw and Juan Quictasee Smith, with comments from Shelby Tisdale and Carolyn Kastner. The Juan Quictasee Smith exhibit is called An American Modernist. Shelby asked both artists about modernism.